Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
What a great first day on the job.
That good?
I help people, I'm in the middle of the action, I use the latest tech, it's a dream job.
Are they hiring?
I got you. I'll put in a word for you. Find out more about a career in insurance at purposemeetspassion.ca.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday, the 8th of March, these are our main stories. Joe Biden attacks Donald Trump in the last State of the Union speech before the US election. Both the US and the European Union announce plans to bring large-scale humanitarian aid into Gaza by sea. Raids are carried out in India against traffickers who've been tricking people into joining the Russian army. Also in this podcast, could the Oscars provide a morale boost for the Ukrainians?
Wars don't start with explosions. They start with silence.
And International Women's Day, what is its significance today? But first, President Joe Biden has taken on critics who say he's too old at 81 to run for office again, delivering a fiery State of the Union speech and claiming that freedom and democracy are under assault around the world. Mr. Biden used the term "my predecessor" to refer to Donald Trump 13 times in a speech that lasted more than an hour. He accused his likely opponent in the election later this year of bowing down to Russia and criticised him over the Capitol riot. Mr. Biden also covered immigration, abortion, the economy and Gaza. His approach to the war in Gaza has been one factor that's been lowering his approval ratings, and he used the speech to announce that the US military will construct a temporary port in Gaza to help get more humanitarian aid to the territory. Our North America correspondent Nomia Iqbal was watching and has this report from Washington.
This was President Biden's make-or-break moment to show Americans why he should be re-elected. No pressure.
Good evening. If I were smart, I'd go home now.
It was a more fiery speech than usual as the 81-year-old tried to prove he's not too old for office. The speech turned quickly into campaign mode.
What makes our moment rare is that freedom and democracy are under attack at both at home and overseas at the very same time.
Though he never referred to his election rival by name.
Now my predecessor, a former Republican president, tells Putin, quote, do whatever the hell you want.
But Donald Trump was on his mind. He reminded America of what happened in this very building on January the 6th, 3 years ago.
Many of you are here on that darkest of days. We all saw with our own eyes the insurrectionists were not patriots.
There were some heckles and boos by his Republican opponents.
Lincoln.
He touched on issues that voters care about, immigration, the economy and reproductive rights.
Many of you in this chamber and my predecessor are promising to pass a national ban on reproductive freedom. My God, what freedom else would you take away?
Fight like hell for the living!
But the journey to get here wasn't straightforward.
People want a ceasefire!
Protesters are gathered here, blocking the main road from the White House to the Capitol. President Biden ended up taking a longer route to make his address on time. But his handling of the war in the Middle East is proving to be one of the biggest issues he's facing ahead of the election.
I think he's already lost votes from many people, from younger voters, from Arab and Muslim voters, from Jewish voters.
The war wasn't ignored in the speech. He paid tribute to the families of Israeli hostages who were invited to the address. Mr. Biden said he was also working to help deliver aid to Palestinians.
I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelter.
The State of the Union was Mr. Biden's big opportunity to get some fresh momentum ahead of the election. If he loses in November, it would be the last one he delivers.
Naomi Iqbal in Washington. In his State of the Union speech, President Biden also said that the US plans to build a temporary port in Gaza to boost aid deliveries. Speaking at a news conference at United Nations headquarters in New York, the UN's humanitarian coordinator for Gaza, Sigrid Karg, gave her reaction to the plan.
We welcome this. At the same time, I cannot but repeat, air and sea is not a substitute for land, and nobody says otherwise. The additionality, however, at this critical juncture will be very important.
Our correspondent Yoland Nell, who's in Jerusalem, told me a little more about how the plan would work.
This comes amid the UN's warnings of widespread famine among the 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza. It does look very much like a political move on the part of Mr. Biden, the desire to show some kind of concrete step. And it's a reflection, too, of the frustration the US has at the moment with its close ally Israel. It's been calling on it repeatedly in recent weeks to increase the flow of aid going into Gaza. But Israel has been very reluctant to open more crossings or to make its Mediterranean ports like Ashdod, which is about a 40-minute drive away from the north of Gaza, more available for incoming aid. I mean, what you have at the moment is a majority of aid being flown to Egypt and entering via two southern crossings. Now, Gaza doesn't have a deep-sea port, so what's being proposed here is to have a kind of temporary pier to transport supplies from ships coming via Cyprus, which is where Israeli security checks will take place, and then brought in to the shore of Gaza. But still a lot of logistical questions about exactly how distribution will take place.
Meanwhile, the European Commission is today trialling a new maritime corridor for delivering aid from Cyprus. On a visit there, the organisation's president, Ursula von der Leyen, said she hoped the initiative would be rolled out by Sunday.
We know the difficulties faced at the land borders in Gaza, be it through the Rafah border crossing or through the Jordan Road corridor. And that is why today the Republic of Cyprus, the European Commission, the United Arab Emirates and the United States, of course supported by other critical partners, announced our intent to open the maritime corridor to deliver much needed additional amounts of humanitarian assistance by sea.
Ahead of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. Meanwhile, the UN agency operating in Gaza, UNRWA, has published a report detailing widespread abuse of Palestinians in makeshift Israeli detention camps. Israel's military insists that mistreatment of detainees is absolutely prohibited. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, told me more about the UN report.
Well, this is an internal UN report that the BBC has seen. It's described as a draft report, but the kinds of testimony from Palestinian detainees that it includes very much tally with reports published recently by Israeli and Palestinian human rights groups, as well as in separate UN investigations. They include a wide range of abuse, being stripped and beaten, being forced into cages and attacked by dogs, forced into stress positions for extended periods of time, and subjected to what it describes as blunt force trauma. That's the use of butts of guns and boots against many parts of the body. All of this based on, the UN says, this is UNRWA, the main UN agency operating in Gaza. It says it spoke to about 100 detainees as they were released from Israel at the Kerem Shalom crossing between Israel and Gaza. It says it obtained those accounts as part of its role coordinating humanitarian aid there. But it estimates that about 4,000 more detainees from Gaza are still being held in Israeli detention centres. It was able to document about 1,000 who were freed.
The Israelis, though, say they're not mistreating anyone.
We asked the Israeli Defense Forces for a statement. They absolutely denied there was mistreatment. They said it was absolutely prohibited. It said it contravened IDF values as well as orders. It specifically denied allegations such as denying detainees water or food or medical care, as well as appropriate bedding. And it dismissed the accusations of sexual violence, seeing it as Hamas propaganda, which it said was trying to establish a false equivalence between what it describes as Hamas's systematic use of rape as a weapon of war. And I should underline that there was no allegation of rape in the account in this document. And it should also be pointed out that this is a very tense moment between Israel and UNRWA. UNRWA is now under investigation itself after Israel presented a document accusing a number of UNRWA employees of being part of the Hamas attacks of October the 7th. UNRWA immediately sacked those employees. It's now investigating those claims that also led to nearly 20 countries and institutions suspending UNRWA's funding just at a time it was desperately needed. But the European Union now has resumed the support, and we understand that other countries are planning to do the same.
Lise Doucette. 10 years ago on Friday, a Malaysian airliner carrying 239 people on a routine flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing vanished in what has become one of the greatest aviation mysteries. There was no distress call nor any indication of a problem. The aircraft, a Boeing 777, has never been found, despite the largest and most expensive search operation ever mounted. A few parts of the plane eventually washed up thousands of kilometres away, and the analysis of radar and satellite data showed it had turned around and headed far into a remote stretch of the southern Indian Ocean. Our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head, who's covered the extraordinary story of flight MH370 from the start, reports from Kuala Lumpur.
At a Buddhist temple not far from Kuala Lumpur International Airport, relatives from China mark 10 years since their inexplicable loss on flight MH370. More than 150 of those on board were from China. One was 29-year-old Li Yanlin. He was the first person in his small farming village to go to university, the first to get a job overseas. His parents, father Li Eryu and mother Liu Shuangfeng, are still struggling to make sense of what happened.
The airline said they had lost contact. All these years I keep asking, what does that mean? I have been searching for my child for the past 10 years, and I think that if you lose contact with someone, surely you should be able to reconnect with them.
Malaysian 370, contact Ho Chi Minh 120.99.
Good night, Malaysian 370. 45 minutes into the flight, this was the last communication between the pilot and air traffic control. Nothing more was ever heard from it. The sheer lack of information created confusion as journalists sought answers from equally baffled Malaysian officials.
There was no such distress signal or distress call, so we are equally puzzled why.
A three-year-long search involving 26 countries found nothing. This was a New Zealand Air Force surveillance plane heading out, one of more than 300 such flights.
There was no organized search of beaches and shorelines for floating debris.
The extraordinary mystery of MH370 also drew in amateur sleuths and researchers like Blaine Gibson.
It simply hadn't been done. They were spending millions of dollars searching underwater. And I just thought, well, probably the first piece of this plane is just going to be found by someone walking on the beach. And I thought, well, I can go ahead and do that myself.
The first piece was found, not by Blaine, on the French island of Réunion, more than a year after the plane vanished. Blaine found several more on East African beaches. For Grace Nathan, whose mother Anne had been on board, it was painful news.
I remember the day that we learnt of the first piece of debris being found. Some part of my world just came crashing down because this was the first point that I had had to, on some level, accept that the plane may have crashed.
As you can see, there is a backdrop behind me where the names of the 239 passengers...
But the plane still hasn't been found, and the last search stopped 6 years ago. So the families hold these commemoration events every year to keep MH370 in the public eye.
No words can describe
the sadness and grief of the relatives, families and friends.
Also at the event was Malaysian Transport Minister Anthony Loke. The government here has been accused of dragging its feet in approving a new search.
There's no reluctance on the part of the Malaysian government?
No reluctance. As far as Malaysian government is concerned, we are committed to that search and the search must go on.
He promised that a new operation was already being negotiated. For the families of those on board, like Chiquita Gonzalez, whose husband Patrick was the in-flight supervisor on MH370, the wait for answers goes on.
I just want the plane to be found, and at least I can let my husband rest in peace. Right now, I have not done anything for him to give him a memorial. I can't, but, you know, it's time that I let him be at peace.
That report compiled by Jonathan Head in Kuala Lumpur. To India now, where police say they have smashed a trafficking network which was sending people to fight for the Russian army in Ukraine. Authorities say 35 recruits had so far been sent to Russia, and deaths of some of those sent have been recorded. Our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etirajan told me more.
According to the Central Bureau of Investigation, that is India's federal investigative agency, what they say is they were using social media, putting out videos on YouTube and on Instagram, asking people to sign up because it is a job in Russia. You'll be getting about $1,500 to $1,800 a month. And some were even promised Russian citizenship within 3 months of joining. But initially, according to police, what they were told was they will be doing some support roles like working as a technical person, like a carpenter or a cook or even, other supportive roles. But then after that, some of these people, they issued a Facebook video saying that they were given weapons training and then asked to go near the battlefield. And as far as we know, at least two Indians have died. And so this is an organized network, and that's why the Indian forces, the security forces, carried out a raid across the country in many cities, like in Delhi, Mumbai, Chennai. And they think one of the mastermind or the guy who was organizing it based in Dubai, because many people went from Dubai. So that is a big issue for the authorities now.
India and Russia, of course, share close ties. Historically, they've been very close nations. How is Delhi dealing with this?
In fact, the story was first reported by a newspaper called The Hindu. In fact, the Indian government was not even aware of this issue. And then it triggered various reactions. And today, the Indian Foreign Ministry spokesperson was saying that these people are duped into the Ukrainian border, and they were talking with Moscow. And as and when they hear proper complaints and get more details, they were trying to get these people back. But then we do not know how many people have been sent. Some estimates suggest it could be as much as 100. And we also hear reports of people being sent from Nepal as well as in Sri Lanka. So it is not simply an issue confining to India, but also across the region.
But it's quite a small number of people compared to the number of Russian troops that are fighting in Ukraine, isn't it?
But we don't know the exact number, how many people have gone. But now the stories are emerging because these people are sending very desperate SOS messages to their families. Please come and take us, or complain to the Indian authorities. We were not told that we will be fighting. So this is a very dangerous territory where you can get killed any time, when people did not even realize that they were going to go and fight in this war.
Anbarasan Etirajan. Still to come in this podcast, new reports of mass bleaching of corals at the Great Barrier Reef. How bad is the situation?
As we mark International Women's Day, discover two podcasts from the BBC World Service celebrating women around the world. Where to Be a Woman is the brand new podcast exploring in which countries women are living their best lives.
And my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for season 3. Join me, Namulanta Kombo, as I update my handbook to life for daughters everywhere.
Search for Where to Be a Woman
and Dear Daughter
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hey, Hotels.com here. Tired of the everyday? We know a hotel that's ready to unwind this weekend. Book hotels with spas in the Hotels.com app. Find your perfect somewhere.
A US congressional panel has approved a bill that would force TikTok's parent company ByteDance, which is based in China, to sell the app or face a ban. It's the latest move in an ongoing wrangle over ownership of the massively popular social media phenomenon, as our reporter Jao Da Silva explains.
The bill is expected to go to a full House floor vote next week. The bill passed despite extensive lobbying by TikTok against it. The company has been in the crosshairs of lawmakers in the United States and elsewhere since 2020, when former President Donald Trump singled it out. The problem is TikTok's parent company, which is a Chinese technology firm called ByteDance, there's concern that data owned by this company on the 170 million users of TikTok in the US and many more around the world, there's concern that this data could be subjected to Chinese law. There's also fears that TikTok could be used as a tool to propagate, to amplify China's influence campaigns. All of this is, of course, denied by TikTok and by ByteDance. TikTok has taken steps to ensure that the data of its users is protected, but obviously it hasn't been enough to ease the concerns of the US political elite.
Jao Da Silva. After years of impressive regrowth reaching record levels in 2022, scientists are once again sounding the alarm over bleaching at the Great Barrier Reef off the Australian coast. Mass bleaching occurs when heat-stressed corals expel the algae that gives them life and colour. The El Nino effect and climate change are being blamed for the new worries. Simon Atkinson reports from Queensland.
Only 7 mass coral bleaching events have ever been recorded on the Great Barrier Reef, but this is the 5th to hit in 8 years. The authority managing the marine park says aerial surveys over 2/3 of the reef confirm that a widespread, often called mass, coral bleaching event is taking place. There's particular concern for southern parts of the reef, which have avoided the worst of previous bleachings. Bleached coral doesn't necessarily die, but experts say it's more susceptible to disease and less likely to reproduce. Later this year, the World Heritage Committee will again consider if the reef should be placed on a list of sites in danger because of concerns over the impact of global heating as well as water pollution. Australia's government says it's doing everything it can to protect the reef, but environmental campaigners Greenpeace say this claim rings hollow because the country continues to expand and subsidise the coal and gas industry, making it a major contributor to the climate crisis.
Simon Atkinson in Australia. Ukraine has been experiencing setbacks in its war with Russia, and Republicans in the US Congress have been holding back billions of dollars in military aid. But there is some potential good news for Kyiv, at least in the cultural arena. Ukraine looks set to possibly savour a moment of Oscars night victory. Tom Brook reports from Los Angeles.
39-year-old Mstislav Chernov could bring Ukraine an Oscars night victory. His film, 20 Days in Mariupol, is widely considered to be the favourite to take home the Best Documentary Feature trophy.
Someone once told me, wars don't start with explosions. They start with silence.
20 Days in Mariupol is not easy to watch. It is not a sanitised view of war. It is footage shot by Mstislav Chernov, video journalist for the Associated Press, with his colleagues in Mariupol in 2022 as Russian forces began to encircle the Ukrainian port city.
This film tells the story of the first 20 days of 86 days siege of Mariupol. Those 20 days became a symbol of how Russia attacked Ukraine, how Russia killed the civilians, what tactics Russia uses to take every single city right now in Ukraine.
20 Days in Mariupol is, in many ways, the story of a city on the edge, in its death throes. The director brings us images of the citizens of Mariupol in the worst moments of their lives. You witness expectant mothers fleeing from a hospital, the dead bodies of men, women and children. The director captures the agonizing grief of those who've just lost loved ones. It's the full violence of war that's on view. The filmmaker seemed to have the trust of those whose tragedy he was documenting.
How did you decide what images to include in the documentary? Because some of the images are unbelievably difficult to watch, aren't they?
It is difficult to watch, but there is a fine balance, and it was one of the most challenging parts of making this film. How do you treat a story? How do you treat the visuals so that you pay respects to victims? Because it's very important to always respect victims of the violence. At the same time, how to not desanitize the footage, how to keep the audience invested and feeling what it's really like to be there.
In recent days, in the run-up to the Oscars, Mstislav Chernov has been here in the US, in New York and Los Angeles and elsewhere, attending screenings of his film. His presence here has helped bring his documentary to the attention of Oscar voters and made it part of the Academy Awards conversation.
Academy members may also have been inclined to vote for the film because they see it as a way of supporting Ukraine at a time when it's been experiencing setbacks on the battlefield and in its efforts to get military aid from the US. But win or lose the Oscar, Mstislav Chernov hopes at least one legacy of his film is that it will provide audiences with lasting proof of the wrongs committed by Russia against his people, that it represents something more enduring than daily news reports from Ukraine.
One of the reasons why it was so important for me to make 20 Days in Mariupol, because when you watch the film, the documentary film, it gives you enough context to make your own informed decisions on what it means. The viewer have enough context to decide how to interpret the images and not to be told how to interpret. That is why the long form films are so important right now.
Mstislav Chernov says he wants his documentary to show the world the suffering and destruction as the war in Ukraine wages on. The Oscar nomination has certainly been bringing attention to his country's plight, as critical today as it was when he first began documenting the siege of Mariupol 2 years ago.
Tom Brook in Los Angeles. March the 8th is International Women's Day. It's an event marked around the world with women taking to the streets and demanding action on issues such as equal pay, reproductive rights and education. This year's theme is Inspired Inclusion, to encourage people to speak out against discrimination, challenge stereotypes and try to overcome prejudice. Stephanie Prentice has this report.
International Women's Day is a time to reflect on the progress women have made around the world, looking at economic opportunity, education, health and political leadership. Events have already been taking place in the Southern Hemisphere, in Australia, the home of one of the most famous feminist speeches in recent history.
If he wants to know what misogyny looks like in modern Australia, he doesn't need a motion in the House of Representatives, he needs a mirror.
Former Prime Minister Julia Gillard speaking to the opposition leader Tony Abbott in 2012, and one group of women in Bondi Beach have been holding an event to raise awareness of how women's roles have changed, training the next generation of lifesavers.
Lifesaving was like in 1907, and then women were allowed to become lifesavers in 1980. So we're making up for lost time.
Across Southeast Asia, hundreds of women have been demonstrating. These women in the Philippine capital, Manila, held signs and shouted slogans asking for equal rights. In Bangkok, protesters dressed like pregnant labourers marched in front of the Democracy Monument. And in Indonesia, activists gathered in front of the Election Agency building in Jakarta. Meanwhile, in China, one group of women are highlighting women's role in strength sports like boxing and weightlifting as an emblem of rejecting societal views that women there must be pale, slim and youthful.
Most people who pursue this look are affected by males' views, but many women are willing to wear more gender-neutral clothes now, so I say that in terms of aesthetics, China has become more diversified in recent years.
In India, where sexual violence is commonplace, events are expected in Mumbai. Leslie Udwin is the director of the award-winning documentary India's Daughter and founder of a think tank calling for education schemes for young men in India.
I interviewed several rapists, gang rapists and murderers. It was as if socio-cultural thinking had put algorithms into their brains. When they saw a woman out at night, I mean, these rapists literally said to me, and so did the lawyers, by the way, that that girl not only deserved what she got, But they had a duty to teach her a lesson.
Over in Europe, special ceremonies to celebrate abortion rights being enshrined in the Constitution are expected in Paris. And across Spain and Italy, protests are organised to denounce violence against women, with events also planned across Latin America, as women across the world who can protest come together under the banner of inspired inclusion. While others in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iran and Ukraine fight for their rights amid war and violence.
Stephanie Prentice. And that's all from us for now. But there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. And on Saturday, our weekly Happy Pod with Harry Bly.
Thanks, Alex. In this week's episode, we're listening to the universe, sort of. NASA has translated data from supernovas and galaxies into sounds. It's called data sonification. You don't want to miss it. Also, meet the man making bees whoop. Professor Martin Benchik is a physicist who's found a way to check on the health of a beehive safely during winter, and when gently tapping on the hive, observed clumsy bees going whoop when they bumped into each other. And we're learning about rare and endangered languages. Here's one. Can you guess what it is?
Uflumkina din nisemmu din l-edizzjoni tal-Happy Pod fuq il-BBC World Service.
If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham, and the producer was Oliver Berlau. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Hey, Hotels.com here. Struggling to keep up with your toddler? We know a hotel that'll keep them entertained. Book family-friendly hotels with pools in the Hotels.com app to find your perfect somewhere.